Hello everybody and welcome once again to another oneliner.com podcast. I, as always, am Craig Eastman, and up in Glasgow, as always, is Scott Morris.
Delighted to meet you, dear boy.
Can we just reiterate that is definitely Glasgow you're in, Scott?
Yes.
Excellent. And in Falkirk, as always, is Drew Tavendale.
How do you?
Bit of a mixed bag this week, taking in some big marquee titles and some smaller ones also. So without further ado, we'll crack on. Transformers Revenge of the Fallen is the second instalment of directorial man-boy Michael Bay's adolescent robot wars effort, and you wouldn't catch me giving it even the slightest of look-ins, so I'm going to defer straight to either Scott or Drew, whoever wants to pick up the ball first.
Well, yeah, it's Transformers. What's to say about it? It's some big stompy robots. They go around being stompy and robotic. It's Transformers. What can you say?
The silly shit.
No, it's not. That's one thing you can't say about it. It's enjoyable. Well, you know, Scott and I both very much enjoyed the first one.
Yes, yes, I do.
This one, it's got similar things happening in it this time. A silly plot added of the evil Decepticons had actually been on Earth about 20,000 years before they thought they'd come, and they're going to try and find Candyman, or the Decepticon, who was like the Fallen. He's some big, bad, stompy, extra baddie, and he goes becomes stompy and robotic, and there's other stompy robots, and they fight each other, and it ends but half an hour too late. And for some of that I actually quite enjoyed, I realise I'm not selling it, but it's Transformers, you know what to expect. It's a pretty decent action film, it's half an hour too long. It's quite entertaining, but not anything like as good as the first one. But if you liked the first one, you should probably go and see this.
And that's it. It's not as good as the first one. Oh my god.
I can't find anything else to say about it. It's Transformers. It's some toy robots stomping about on a screen.
You're right, it probably is all you need to know. If you liked the first one, get help. You'll go and see this one in the meantime. If you didn't like the first one, sensible, don't go and see. You probably won't go and see this one anyway. Scott, can you expand?
Well, it's the first film again, but a lot more of it, and frankly, far too much of it. It's actually at least an hour too long. There's a halfway decent 90-minute film that's just stretched out into, what, 2.5 hours or something. There's umpteen plot strands that go absolutely nowhere and completely redundant. There's about 8 separate comic relief characters. It doesn't seem to know what it's trying to do. It suffers even more from the not knowing who the hell was fighting who by the time it gets to the end of it.
Yeah, and then it also steals large chunks from things like Terminator 3, which is probably a bad move, by inventing Sluttlebot.
Mm-hmm. It's Sluttlebot?
It's frankly a mess. I mean, the only thing I liked about it, well, it does its job of selling toys and having big stompy robots going about, and that's really all that it's trying to do, and it's all that it does. Even as someone that quite liked the first film, I can't really actually recommend this one at all. I thought it was completely redundant. It's just not that great. Okay, nice effects, but then again, who cares about that, really?
What? Well, you said you really enjoyed the effects in the first one. Don't be backpedalling now.
I enjoyed the effects in this, but it is just a big tentpole effects movie. And
yeah,
really
it's just 2.5 hours of effects, and that's exactly surely the problem with it.
Too much of it. Definitely way too much of it.
The why does Michael Bay feel the need to make a film that long? Does Michael Bay, in his own mind, actually think that he's doing something important with character development in these films? Because obviously I haven't seen this one. I'd sooner take a bullet than go and see this film, literally, on point of principle. The first film was just the same, though. It was nearly 2.5 hours long. It was completely devoid of plot. It was completely devoid of character development. It had about 3 set pieces stretched out throughout the whole film, about an hour at a time of absolutely nothing happening. So what is the point in it? Surely they'd be better making a shorter film. They can show it more times in the multiplex and make more money in a weekend. Why is he spouting out this 2.5 hour piece of shit?
Well, I think you probably struck on it within Michael Bay's own mind. A few weeks ago, I read an excerpt of an interview with Megan Fox, who's saying, he said something along the lines of, "I can't be too down on Transformers. It's launched my career, it's allowed me lots more opportunities. But let's be fair here, or honest here, it's not really a film about acting." And
no.
Michael Bay responded to that, and you could just hear the pitying tones in his voice, like, "Oh, bless, the wee girl doesn't know what she's talking about," by saying,
she does.
Saying that she was wrong, she doesn't really know what she's talking about, but she's just young, oh, bless. But that's the spot. Of course it's not about the
she's
acting.
She's clearly not as young in mind as Michael Bay is.
Yeah, I know.
He literally is a 12-year-old boy, isn't he?
Yeah, but the point being, I think he is deluded. It's in his own mind. He thinks this is some great story that he's telling here.
Yeah. I think he's caught Brett Ratner syndrome, although possibly might have been the other way about.
But any Michael Bay
film that's been enjoyable has almost nothing to do with Michael Bay. It's all second unit stuff. It's all the effects work. It's all the stunt stuff, which Bay's probably not going to have that much to do with. And let's face it, the dramatic elements which he's directing is generally the weakest part of any Michael Bay film.
So he
should just shut up.
Michael Bay can direct traffic.
Yeah, and the most enjoyable Michael Bay films too. The reason that they're entertaining is because the actors like Nick Cage and Sean Connery and Bruce Willis are considerably more entertaining than Michael Bay can direct them to be. It's all because of them, in spite of him, rather than because of him.
They treated the material in the sort of borderline camp nature that it needed to be approached in order to make it entertaining.
Yeah.
Whereas unfortunately, ever since then, every Michael Bay film, whether or not he's actively clamped down on that or for some reason people just treat it that way now, they just take it far too seriously. The only person I don't think has taken it seriously in a Michael Bay film has been, John Turturro in the first Transformers film. I don't know if he pops up in this one again.
He does.
But you got... Yeah, does he? I mean, I got the impression in the first one that he wasn't taking it too seriously, whereas everyone else seemed to be, so... I don't know. Maybe that's the key to a good Michael Bay film, the actor's taking the piss out of him.
Well, he is the character in this film who uncovers the apparently top-secret US weapons program. They have a railgun, except this top-secret hush-hush weapon is mounted to the front of a fucking aircraft carrier. Yeah, hiding in plain sight, I guess.
Dear, that's something he's stolen from a Razor as well, if I remember correctly. There was talk in a Razor, was saying about, oh, we've got real guns, but the smallest one we have is mounted on a battleship. There you go, that's just a by-the-by. Yeah, Michael Bay, retard. I'd like to be locked in a room with that man. I really would. The possibilities are endless. The arrival of a new Michael Mann film is always something to look forward to, and with the red herring of Miami Vice aside, the director has proven himself beyond doubt one of America's greatest living filmmakers. With Public Enemies, Mann has chosen to explore the familiar territory of Hunter and Hunted, this time through the historical prism of John Dillinger's bank-robbing escapades across 1930s America, with gangster cohorts Pretty Boy Floyd and Babyface Nelson. Johnny Depp portrays Dillinger, fugitive to Christian Bale as lawman Melvin Purvis, and Marion Cotillard has seemingly been forgiven her 9/11 outburst in time to portray Depp's female companion Billy Frechette. Dillinger's enigmatic escapades and subsequent rise to folk hero status are a matter of well-worn public record, so can Mann, with his fancy handheld digital cameras back in tow, cast new light on one of modern America's most notorious figures, Scott?
No.
Drew. No, carry on, Scott.
The problem with Public Enemies, I mean, it's very well shot, as you'd expect, and given the acting talent, you've got Christian Bale, Johnny Depp, umpteen others, it's very well acted, and it's well enough put together. It's just not a particularly interesting story. I've never quite understood the American fascination with turning these hardened criminals into some kind of folk hero, which has been happening all the way throughout, and apparently John Dillinger's a nice guy because he doesn't shoot people quite as much as other bank robbers were at the time. He's morally reprehensible, as is pretty much everyone in it. It would be far more interesting if more time was spent with the Melvin Purvis's fledgling FBI service trying to track him down, but that's more or less a sideline. It focuses far too much on Dillinger, but there's not really anything interesting in Dillinger's character that makes me want to focus on it for that length of time. I think for that reason alone, and possibly for that reason only, I didn't actually enjoy Public Enemies that much. I mean, it is competently produced enough that it's not a disappointing film to watch, but there's really no drive there. There's no hook to it. I just couldn't find myself getting into it or emphasising with any of them. It only seems to be the out-and-out villainy of Babyface Nelson towards the end of it, which is sort of giving it, making him seem like a heroic character just by contrast. And it's just not particularly interesting.
I'm normally a fervent Michael Mann fan, but am I to be glad that I didn't get a chance to see this?
You're not missing much, frankly.
That's a disappointment to hear.
Like Scott, I share his difficulty and comprehension of why this, quite frankly, brutal, murdering bastard should be so elevated in public consciousness. It's something that the United States shares with Australia, too. Ned Kelly, quite possibly the most unpleasant person you could hope to meet or hope to avoid.
Aside from Chopper Reed.
Is a real folk hero, and I don't understand why. I mean, the film, it's slickly produced, it looks nice. I wouldn't go as far as saying the acting was great. It's certainly not the best performance I've seen from either Deb or Christian Bale. Just, I didn't find myself hating Dillinger quite as much as I would have done, despite the fact he's clearly a murdering bastard. Still, because I'm thinking, that's Johnny Depp, quite like him. I never got sort of engrossed enough in it to actually care. Like, there's just some stuff happening. Nice suit.
Yeah, but in this film you're not supposed to hate. Dillinger. He's not presented as a figure of hate, despite what he's doing.
Yeah.
He's the crazy, cheeky chappy who goes around robbing banks and keeping it, sort of like Robin Hood, but half of Robin Hood. The acting performances with both him and Bale are pretty much limited by the fact that the characters aren't very interesting, so what you got to do?
Yeah, I know. I mean, it's like Deb has got a good cast in terms of sort of for the charming side of Dillinger, but you still see him murder people pretty much in cold blood, so you should still hear him. I just never got engrossed enough in it to like really be thinking, oh, that's John Dillinger's voice. That's Johnny Depp with a Tommy gun. I like Tommy guns, they're cool. And also, it doesn't help that Babyface Nelson's played by Stephen Graham. And I just, every time I see him on screen, I just keep on thinking.
Weird.
I want to, like, I'm expecting to talk about the Germans. Where's Statham? Statham to tell the Germans are coming to get proper fucked.
No, someone at work was telling me the other day it was odd to hear him speaking, I think possibly for the first time without an English accent.
Oh, he's got an American accent, Band of Brothers, but it's not a big role.
I can't even remember him being in Band of Brothers. There you go.
He's one of the sergeants that tries to get your friend's fella, David Schwimmer, thrown out. He gets sacked for it, demoted.
Of course. Yeah. You're right.
Yeah. Although, actually, just not with Babyface Nelson. The other thing I thought every time I saw Babyface Nelson was I kept wanting to shoot some cows and say, I hate cows more than coppers. So really, if you want to see a film with Babyface Nelson, I suggest you see Old Brother, Where Art Thou instead.
And why not?
Because he shoots some cows.
I'm just... Oh, so that's a recommendation. If you fancy Public Enemies, go and see Old Brother, Where Art Thou instead. Okay. Different kettle of fish entirely. Ken Loach isn't generally regarded as the most upbeat director in the world. His body of work, frequently comprising many tales of chain-smoking alcoholics beating people up, screaming and crying quite a lot. Having said that, he does like to offer a bit of levity every now and again, and although Looking for Eric is ostensibly about a postman frequently considering suicide, it does offer football's most philosophical of ambassadors, Eric Cantona, as a wisdom-spouting hallucination who saves said postman, played by Steve Evetts, by pure force of genius alone. Drew, tell us a little bit more about Looking for Eric.
Well, we said Steve Evetts is a postman, his wife's left him some time ago, he's got two stepsons to bring up. He's got some friends around him who try in various comic ways to cheer him up, but he's pretty much on a downward spiral that he can't get out of. And it's not helped by the fact that his elder stepson is in tow with a local gangster and has to keep a gun for him.
Cool.
Finds his the same elder stepson's stash of cannabis, rolls up a joint, has a wee smoke, and suddenly Eric Cantona is appearing to him, talking to him.
Someone get me some of that.
So as he tries to recreate a relationship with his first wife, as the great love of his life, who he meets while babysitting for their daughter, he just has lots of conversations about philosophy and life and stuff with old Eric there. And not much more to say other than it's awfully, awfully good.
Fair enough.
I don't want to say Scott, what happens, because that's what's enjoyable about it.
Fair enough. Scott, is that something you'd agree with?
Yeah, well, there's not an awful lot that happens in the whole film, but that's no barrier to enjoyment. It's very enjoyable. I should add, we watched this film before we undertook this whole festival nonsense, so quite a lot of the details have been sort of scrubbed by the avalanche of films I've seen since then.
Mm.
But I just wanted to mention it, because I did find it very enjoyable. I think it's one of the best films of the year.
Yeah, absolutely.
It's a charming performance, I think, from both Steve Evett and Cantona himself. Proves to be quite self-effacing and happy to, I assume, pretty much send himself up for quite a lot of these things. he certainly proves to be the best imaginary friend that a man could have. Very wise and endearing. Yeah, thoroughly enjoyed it. I'd imagine it's probably not far off poking up on DVD by this point, so definitely worth a look.
Yeah.
Fair play.
There's only this one slight proviso in that simply, if you do get it on DVD, you may want to check out the subtitle simply because at points Cantona's accent is so thick, it really is hard to hear what he's saying, even on the volume of a cinema sound system.
I made a joke.
You're such a wit. that's a minor proviso, but yeah, it's just really, really good. What more do you say about it? It's excellent performances all round. It's entertaining, it's really funny and touching and tragic, and it's just excellent.
Absolutely, what more do you say? This reviewer attempting to shed light on a Harry Potter film is a bit like asking a newborn baby its opinion on the current world financial crisis. with no frames of reference whatsoever, other than trailers and puff pieces for the first couple of films, I can tell you only that Peter Yates returns as director, and the action, I assume, must pick up pretty much from where the last film left off. Despite being almost completely absent from the film, the influence of Voldemort's evil hand can be felt in full effect as a plot to murder a major character within Hogwarts unfolds, and we learn a little more of the Dark Lord's childhood. What I will say for this sixth instalment in the franchise is that it seems a fairly effective vehicle. The cast are uniformly decent in their roles, and I found the three main child actors far less abrasive and precocious than I had first expected, and rather quite accomplished in their endeavours, in fact. Peter Yates seems quite assured in his direction, and succeeds in building an atmosphere of impending tragedy that permeates the entire film. Unfortunately for a newcomer like myself, there is little by way of excitement or spectacle to punctuate the significant running time, so I shall have to defer to more enlightened opinions to tell you if this is a worthy entry in the Potter canon. Unfortunately, more enlightened opinions aren't present at the moment, because both the guys haven't seen it yet, so perhaps next podcast we'll do a quick catch up on this and see if you guys can give a more informed, is the only word I suppose, a more informed opinion on the film than I can. I will say it wasn't half as bad as I expected. It's just that for I hate to use the word, but a muggle like myself,
I hate you for using the word.
Excellent. There isn't actually much excitement going on to make me think I might want to watch another one. But I don't know if within the canon of Harry Potter films, this the character development and whatnot going on will prove more exciting to someone who has more of an insight than I do. So we'll see how that goes anyway next week or in the next couple of weeks, when hopefully we will be chatting to you about what other stuff, Scott? Land of the Lost, I think, perhaps?
Well, two things. I'm certainly not going to be talking about Harry Potter. I have no intention of seeing it after the last film being so unmemorable that I keep forgetting that it's actually been made. And also, you've not spoken about Ice Age and The Hangover yet, so...
Oh, shit! Sacha Baron Cohen struck what seemed to be a rich seam of comedy gold when he released Borat to a world audience back in 2006. His left-field creation set loose on an unsuspecting Americana made for funny, if occasionally painful, watching, and it always seemed likely the comedian would return with another of his stock characters. Enter Bruno, the gay Austrian fashionista whose cinematic exploits come coupled with accusations that this time the victims are in on the joke, and that Cohen has been diverted into increasingly shocking behaviour to try and up the ante. By this point in human history, we're used to films being labelled shocking, so is there any truth to these accusations, and, more importantly, is Bruno actually worth the entrance fee? Drew, were you shocked and appalled?
I was certainly not appalled. I'm pretty sure I've never been shocked in my life, and certainly not by a film, other than perhaps by Full Frontal for its sheer awfulness. But as to this, no, I mean, some of the stuff's a bit more, I don't know, lurid, perhaps, than it was in Borat. But, I mean, to all intents and purposes, it's Borat too. It's a nearly identical character doing nearly identical things, but just not quite as fun as it was done before, possibly because it's being done again. It's worth the entrance fee. If you like Borat, you always certainly like this. You'll get some entertainment out of it. Some of it's really funny, but there's nothing special about it. It's not particularly memorable. There's not much more to say. It's Borat too. If you like Borat, you'll enjoy this. Just it's not quite as good.
That's fair enough. Scott, did it raise a chuckle of mirth in your soul?
Well, it did, but I'm not sure it actually did enough to warrant recommending it. It's reasonably entertaining. I agree with pretty much all Drew said, but it's just lacking in teeth. It's going out of its way to try and appear shocking, but it's not really. It is just funny accents and nudity again. Aye, it does what you expect it to do. And it's roundly unspectacular. It's all right. I can't really get myself worked up into any sort of recommendation for it. It's doing essentially everything you've seen before. If you saw the trailer, you can pretty much write the entire film yourself. It's tiresome in places, and it is funny in other places. I'll admit, there's a few decent gags in there, but for the most part, it's just doing things that you could think of yourself fairly quickly. Yeah, not massively impressed with it, to be honest.
All right, calm down. True, you're going to give us a bit of a rundown on Ice Age 3D, Dawn of the Dinosaurs, aren't you?
I am, yes.
Good man.
That's Ice Age Dawn of Dinosaurs. It's got the unlikely hair familiar to viewers from the previous two films. That's Manny the Mammoth, Diego the Cybertooth Tiger, Sid the Sloth.
The Cybertooth Tiger?
What?
You did call him a Cybertooth Tiger.
Yes,
which is very Web 3.0, but
it is, yeah.
Well, he's a Cybertooth Tiger. He's one of those Dinobots from Transformers. It's just a bit of a crossover. Sid Sloth, the Diego Sabertooth Tiger, Man and Man, joined by ICH2's second mammoth, Ellie. They're all plunged into peril once again as they discover a tropical world hidden beneath their icebound homeland, because apparently it's much warmer right below the ice.
That'll happen.
This tropical world, of course, being replete with big, chompy, stompy dinosaurs. The hapless Sid is taken into this world by a mummy Tyrannosaurus Rex, whose eggs he was foolish enough to steal. Friends, aided by the weasel Buck, voiced by series newcomer Simon Pegg, must rescue him.
I mean, you said mummy Tyrannosaurus Rex.
Yeah, I've got two images there to choose from. Do at any point, does one of them just grab a hold of the end of a loose bandage and reveal it to be an actual Tyrannosaurus Rex? It looks like a mummy Tyrannosaurus Rex. Ah, oh, it's just a Tyrannosaurus Rex wrapped in bandages. Oh dear, Scooby-Doo crossover right there.
It's already got the arms stuck out stiffly in front of it down to a T.
Oh my goodness. Carry on.
Well, Sid gets into his usual scrapes. He's regularly insulted by his friends, who still go out of their way to help him, and all.
Those bastards. It's like they earn the right to insult him.
Yeah.
Haha, we saved your life, it belongs to us now, you bastard.
Oh well, they still sell him anyway, and all sorts of lessons are learned about friendship and family values and blah blah blah. If it sounds less than fantastic, that's because it is. It's also less than hugely enjoyable, and even the presence of Simon Pegg can't help it. His character Buck is wacky and possibly even zany. Adjective certain to strike fear into the hearts of many, including myself. Not that the film could have reasonably described as bad, however, it is resoundingly mediocre. The voice acting is mediocre. The charmless animation and environments, the story, such as it is, the characters and dialogue are all mediocre. And going by the reaction of the children in the cinema when I was watching this, they found it enjoyable enough. And it's not so bad or dull that any adult accompanying the children who it's aimed at will be completely bored by it. It's just that there are so many better films available that it absolutely cannot be recommended. And any family would be far better off saving their money and watching any number of greater films on DVD.
No, I was just going to say, I mean, I haven't seen this instalment, but Ice Age and Ice Age 2 would be best described in my book as mediocre. And I don't buy the excuse that, oh yeah, but it's okay for kids, because time was when a children's film could be excellent for adults and also excellent for children. Yeah. I don't buy that it's acceptable just to stick a bunch of funny animals in front of kids they'll lap it up. I think we're doing kids a great disservice with the Pixar aside, perhaps, with the
but it's in the 3D offense now, so.
Oh shit, yeah, I was
coming to that.
It's got one extra dimension of goodness.
I was going to say, I mean, it's a pity that the utterly delightful Coraline, which knocks Ice Age 3 into all kinds of cocked hats, isn't available to buy in this country for a few months yet. Because if you want a proper children's film that treats audience with respect, it's actually good for adults and children, that's a stunning example.
It certainly is.
Just a final word of advice for anyone listening to this who is still going to watch this regardless of my comments. You'll certainly want to at least save the money by not watching the 3D version if your cinema has the choice. The 3D adds absolutely nothing to this movie. The lackluster visual style of the films, which I've never liked, even if the first Ice Age was at least entertaining, is not lifted in any way at all by the technology and would be money wasted.
I think that pretty much applies to anything in 3D at the moment, doesn't it?
Some of them, like Coraline, actually, in 3D, I just thought added my sense of depth, and it's maybe not worth the extra, but it just added a bit of depth.
I think we're going to have to wait for Jim Cameron's Avatar to see anyone actually hopefully do anything interesting with 3D, but even at that, I just don't buy that you can actually do anything interesting with 3D full stop. Because at the end
not.
Of the day, it's just things coming out of the screen, so there's a limit to that. Again, I'm willing to believe it might be an awesome film, but I fail to see how 3D can add to anything. We're being sold a pup here. It's unbelievable. It really is unbelievable. And bizarrely as well, no one seems to have picked up yet this argument of, oh, you know, it's a device to sort of stop piracy. Yes, well, most cinemas are also showing 2D versions of all these films as well. Yeah. So I'm not sure. I'm not sure how much of a deterrent it is.
I'm actually really quite angered too. I don't know if other cinemas are the same, cinema chains, but the cinema chain we frequent, Cineworld, have signs on their doors printed out saying, why a 3D film is more expensive? And then they go on about it costing more to produce and having to pay more for the glasses and stuff. And it's all nonsense, especially when you've got a whole lot of people banging on saying that because TVs are getting so big and so good-looking nowadays, people are watching more at home, that the whole idea of the hook of a 3D film is that you can only get that experience in cinemas. So that's what they want to use that to make sure people still keep going to the cinema. But if that's the case, why does it cost more?
Yeah, exactly. That's part of the cinema's infrastructure, and it's their cost to bear, not ours.
I love how they say they cost more to produce, so therefore they should be more expensive. Well, I'm pretty sure Titanic costs more to produce than, say, Moon.
Yeah. I'm pretty sure Transformers...
They don't have different prices.
I'm pretty sure Transformers 2 cost vastly more to produce than Ice Age 3, and Transformers 2 wasn't in 3D.
Yeah. It is just a cynical ploy to get people in the cinemas, because at the end of the day, you can't watch these films in 3D at home.
I wouldn't consider that necessarily cynical. They're saying, right, that this is, we consider this an event, whether you think it is or not, that's different, but listen, maybe think it's an event, it's a technology you can only experience in the cinema, so it's going to get people to the cinema, okay, but don't charge more for it then.
Especially
get more people and charge exactly the same, and then you'll get more people coming.
Well, yes, and again, a point you've both made backed up completely by the fact of what I said earlier of, yes, the 2D version of it showing next door for £2 less.
Yeah.
So sorry, but that wasn't produced as an entirely separate film, I'm guessing.
Well, they just clicked a different render button on their...
Yeah, well, that's the thing. Certainly, in the case of CGI films, there's really no additional cost whatsoever in producing a 3D version of it.
Which is sometimes they just create a different virtual camera, but there's no extra cost, but just some extra timed rendering. That's it.
Exactly. So we're not buying it, you scumbags. Scott, what was your opinion on Ice Age? Are you down with the kids?
I've not seen it, so
good. In that case, then, we are left with only The Hangover, a buddy Vegas old guys having a fantastic time comedy, which I'm assuming is not entirely in the same vein as Swingers. Scott, what's it all about?
Is it in the same vein as Swingers? Probably not. It is, unsurprisingly, more in the vein of something like Old School, but essentially a group of friends go off to Vegas for a stag weekend, and when they wake up in the morning, the groom has vanished, and no one can remember what on earth has happened in the last night. They don't know why they've suddenly got a baby in a cupboard, and they don't know why there's a tiger in the bathroom. Basically, the whole film revolves around trying to work out what the hell happened the night before that's got them all into such a mess in all the sort of states. And it proves to be a pretty funny ride. It's got a lot of things going for it. It has moments of extreme, perhaps bad taste is not quite the right term, but just extremely inappropriate sayings. Some characters are there's at least one character in there who's just strange and comes out with weird things continually. There's little naked Korean guys running about and all sorts of madness. It is, for want of a better term, zany, but it's actually funny zany rather than bad zany. Some of the characters are fairly sympathetic, particularly Ed Helms, the Daily Show correspondent. And even despite the fact that it does have Mike Tyson in it, who really shouldn't be allowed to do anything, given that he is Mike Tyson and is
a convicted rapist.
Pretty much convicted evil. That aside, it's really rather funny, and I enjoyed it quite a lot.
Good grief. Drew, did you get as much enjoyment from The Hangover?
I certainly did, yeah. Nothing much more to add to what Scott said. A lot of it's quite predictable. I mean, for example, when Stu, that's Ed Helms' reserve dentist, is defending his friends, his partner, and claiming that they're not loud and puerile as she thinks. We see through the window behind him his friends pull up outside and begin shouting juvenile obscenities. I mean, he knew that was going to happen. It's really obvious it was going to happen. And there's sort of similar things to the film. The thing about cliches like that and elsewhere in the film is that they may be predictable, but if they're done well enough, as they are here, they're still bloody funny.
Certainly more funny than a real Hangover.
Yes. Well, I assume so. I've never had one. People hate me for that.
You've never had one.
I've never had one. I don't get them.
Carry
you
on.
You hate me now, don't you?
Don't hate you. I just don't believe you. Carry on.
No, it's true.
See, you might be shocked by that, but Drew's not, because Drew never gets shocked.
Yeah.
I've not much more to say. It's really funny and nicely from a running characters Hope ends up in more Todd Phillips films. The wedding singer guy from Old School pops up in this too, just singing hugely inappropriate songs, which are very, very funny. So if that's a running theme in his films, I'll look forward to that. I would say it's complete nonsense, though, and IMDb need to sort out their rating system, because it's currently sitting as the number 161 in IMDb's top 250 films of all time. Now, it's very entertaining, but that's quite clearly Boz.
Boz.
Well, on that note, I think that just about wraps it up for this week. Hopefully at some point in the near future we will be back with reviews of what stuff, Scott?
I don't know.
He doesn't know. Some stuff. And perhaps next time round we think Drew might have had a chance to catch up with Harry Potter, and he will be able to shed a far more assertive critical eye over it than I might. So thanks once again for listening. Remember, if you want to get in touch, it's podcast@theoneliner.com, and you can, hell, even if it's just to insult us, we don't care, we just like the mail. So yes, thank you for listening. I, as always, have been Craig, and Scott was undoubtedly Scott.
Bye.
And no one can deny that Drew was Drew.
Farewell.
Never had a hangover in his life. Smell yous all later. I, as always, am Craig Eastman, and as always in Edinburgh is Scott Morris, and he's not in Edinburgh. Why the fuck do I get hung up on Edinburgh?